Hello, everybody, and welcome back to yet another Science Studio program. This is Keith Pannell, and in the studio today, apart from having Russ Chianelli, the co-host of the program from time to time, we are also going to have a special guest all the way from Scotland, although he's living somewhere else now. His name is Fraser Stoddart, which sounds very nice. He's actually Sir Fraser Stoddart because he was given a knighthood by the Queen a few years ago, and he is a chemist, a materials chemist, and of course of great fame as he received the Nobel Prize in Chemistry, shared it with two other people in 2016. And so we're going to be talking to Fraser Stoddart about his career, what he did to get the Nobel Prize, and just generally how is life when you've got a Nobel Prize. So Fraser, welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you.
So before we get into what you did and what you're doing in terms of science, how did it begin? I know you come from Edinburgh or in that part of the world. How did you become a scientist?
Well, let me go back a bit. It began on a mixed arable farm about a dozen miles south of the capital of Scotland, Edinburgh. And that I call the University of Life because it taught me to be effectively a hard worker and into the bargain to be able to multitask. And it was interesting because I covered the era from the horse and cart to the combine harvester. I also had very supportive parents, and when it came time for my schooling to start, I was an only child. I went for 3 years to the local village school. There were only five of us to begin with. It mushroomed to 28 when I left in 1950 at the age of eight. And that was one of these one-room schools with one teacher. So I also learnt the whole act of helping people who were younger than me and perhaps slightly, you know, less able than me. And then my mother, who took the lead on this, decided I should go to a school in Edinburgh called Melville College. So I went there and I had my 10 years of primary and secondary education. And I've got to say, with I think some of the most erudite and well-qualified teachers, both men and women, that one could conceive of. I didn't appreciate this at the time, but I now rationalize it in terms of these people were seven or eight generations removed from the time of the Scottish Enlightenment. And so there was this great, I think, history of education being not only important, but being delivered in a very upmarket kind of way. And so I was a great beneficiary of a great education.
Was this a boarding school?
No, it wasn't a boarding school.
So you traveled to and
I traveled back
day.
And forth. It was only 12 miles. So was I used the bus service to begin with, although that was 3 miles away from my home. So I had to be carted back and forth in the family's car. And then as soon as I was 16, I got on two wheels and I was able to
So you remember then getting up in the morning when it was dark, going to school, coming back and it was still dark.
Oh, yes. And what's more, getting up and having 2-3 hours feeding cattle and helping my parents. I was an only child, as I said. We had no electricity until I went to the university at 18. So there were all kinds of amazing challenges. And then at night I could be coming back, and if it was the lambing season, that could go on all night.
And so was it all the hard work on the farm that made you think I'd like a career in science?
It was, to some extent. I mean, it was a tenant farm. My parents didn't have any long association with it. So in 1968, when they decided to leave, I had left already to go to Canada. That was the closure on the farm. And they never expected me to stay in farming. My father had been the son of a professional golfer, and my mother had come from farming stock.
All right. Do you play golf?
Badly. My father took me to a 9-hole golf course, I think, when I was maybe about 8 or 9, and I did not really connect with the fact that this young boy, my father, that is, had been brought up in a golf course. And so at the first tee, I'm making no progress, and then he steps up and hits the ball, even though he maybe hadn't done it for 30 years with machine-like precision. That was the end of my golf. I knew that I could never catch up.
And so then in the school you became a scientist. You just fell in love with the experiments you did or the teachers? Or?
By three fantastically good science teachers of different natures. There was the man from the West Coast called Jimmy Wallace, and it turned out later on that he had been at school with my father. So, you know, you find out quite quickly in life, in Scotland at least, that you live in a village. We had a woman from the Outer Hebrides who was a different style, and then we had a recent young graduate, Ronnie King, from the university. And so I had a good flavour for seeing the science in different ways. And then, of course, at home, these were the days when you had chemistry sets. And but more than the chemistry set, my Meccano set was, I think, my great love, following on the back of addiction to jigsaw puzzles. But the Meccano set is still in the
Russell,
family.
Do you know what a Meccano set is?
I can imagine. It's
well, Rector sets in the United States.
We used to have a Rector set.
Right, yeah. Exactly. And those little nuts and bolts.
Yeah, yeah. So we still have it, and it's been left with parts made and so on. It's a little bit of chaos. So
you, after your bachelor's degree in Edinburgh, and you stayed on for a PhD there, which is very typical in Europe, more so than in the US, where there's an encouragement to move away. What did you do as a graduate student?
Well, I had great encouragement to stay on because I had started effectively my PhD as an undergraduate. And the story is quite an interesting one. The person who was running a third year in the Scottish course is a four-year one at that time, and still is, I think, was introducing a course on quantitative analytical chemistry, you know, how much iron is in this sample of steel. And he had a lot of bluster, and he came out in front of 150 of us with, there was enough cyanide in the lab, and you'll be pipetting it to kill the whole of Edinburgh. And we're all shaking in our boots. And then he went one step too far. He said, this is a 10-week course. I have, you know, put it together about 10 years ago, and nobody's ever finished it. And at that point, my mind clicked, and I said, I will show you. I will finish this course. And by multitasking, you know, what I'd learned on the farm, I finished it in 7 weeks. So then I get taken right up to the top to the professor's office, and, you know, I'm congratulated, and I'm asked if I would like to come and work in a research laboratory, and that was with the person who had given the course, incidentally. So for the fairly small sum of £120, I think it was, for the sort of three-month period during the summer, I started my research activity in a laboratory, and I was bitten by the bug, and it's never gone away. It's a total addiction.
So what was the title of your thesis? What was the actual topic?
It was the study of acacia gums.
Of which?
So these gums are from the Sudan, produced by acacia trees, and I think the common name is gum arabic, finds its way into many confectionaries. And the person I was working with had some sort of route to getting this natural product. And so these nodules would come in with great frequency. And he had all sorts of ideas about how to...
acacia gums.
How to help the growers to produce gum that would be useful to the confectionery industry. Some of them produced what was a stringy situation in solution. So these were called stringy nodules, and then there were the well-behaved ones that produced nice solutions in there.
Did you ever nibble on them, taste them?
Of course, yeah, but they were completely bland in their taste, you know, so there was no great encouragement to go on eating gum arabic. But, of course, they find their way into, I might kind of say it, round trees, fruit gums, and things like that.
So the point of the research then was to, at that stage, to determine what were the components of the gum?
That's right.
If you could maybe refine that later on to make better properties, et cetera.
Yeah, it was to get better physical properties. So my contribution was to question the interpretation of the structure. It was a four-sugar component acidic polysaccharide, and the view at the time was that it was a very long chain with some short branches coming off it. And by thinking about the fact that you could dissolve a large amount of it in water, and then we did a lot of viscometry, and the solutions we just raced down the viscometer, I you know, felt this is a wrong structural interpretation. This is a big ball. So in modern parlance, it's a dendrimer.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, Fraser, you just mentioned the word chains, you know, these long chains of this gum. And that sort of is a nice segue into what is your fame. You're making chains, but chains that do funny things. So we're going to take a quick break, and then we'll come back and we'll talk precisely about what it is that you did that has astonished the world and made everybody very excited for the sheer elegance of the compounds. You're listening to Science Studio, Keith Pannell, Russ Chianelli, and our guest today is Fraser Stoddart from Northwestern University, who was recently awarded the Nobel Prize in Chemistry in 2016, to be precise. We'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. David Neisel.
And I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog. In the next 3 decades, an additional 10 million people will die from multidrug-resistant bacteria.
One solution to this monumental problem is to create new antibiotics, but that can take a decade to develop and approve. Another more efficient solution is to optimize the use of current antibiotics.
Using this approach, a novel solution involves something called quantum dots, which makes bacteria more susceptible to existing antibiotics. These quantum dots are made of a chemical called cadmium telluride.
The molecules are about the width of a strand of DNA, which is 3 nanometers or 1/15,000th the thickness of a sheet of paper.
When these particles are exposed to green light, they lose electrons. The charged subatomic particles then interact with oxygen to form a very reactive molecule called superoxide.
Bacteria that interact with these superoxides become damaged, which makes them 1,000 times more vulnerable to antibiotics.
In experiments, the quantum dots were effective against a number of serious disease-causing bacteria, including MRSA, Salmonella, Klebsiella, and E. coli.
One major weakness of the therapy is that green light can only penetrate a few millimeters into the skin and tissue. So scientists are looking for alternative types of light that can penetrate deeply into the tissue and organs.
Time will tell if quantum dots will be the lifesaver we need as bacterial superbugs continue to find their way around our arsenal of antibiotics.
We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Russ Chianelli, Fraser Stoddart. And so, Fraser, why don't you tell us, you know, what was the idea behind making these interesting molecules that interact with one another, and little machines, as they are called, and that have led to a lot of very interesting science?
Well, the idea is not really one that can be melted down into any sort of moment. The progress towards it was a hugely incremental one, and it has covered 50 years. So, you know, it starts with me getting introduced to large rings when I'm in Canada, and the appearance in the April of 1967 of a paper by a man called Charles Pederson from the DuPont Laboratories describing a very big ring. It had 18 atoms, 12 of them were carbon and 6 of them were oxygen. Flew in the face of all my teaching at Edinburgh. And when I had left Edinburgh, my professor said to me, whatever you do in life, Stoddart, as a chemist, make sure you tackle a big problem. And I just looked at him, I think, completely bamboozled. I had no idea what he meant by this big problem statement. But I was so lucky, within less than 2 months of getting to Canada, by being in the library, I said, this has to be important. This flies in the face of everything that I've been told during my undergraduate and graduate time at Edinburgh. So follow the big rings. And of course, big rings are necessary before you can start to put rings together. They have to be at least 20, 21, 22 membered rings in the number of atoms that constitute
those are
them.
The famous molecules that are called crown ethers.
Yes, yes.
Because there's a conformation where you can think of all the little oxygen sticking up like a coronet.
Yes, yes.
And, very elegant.
And Pederson had the, association with Norway and his family to be able to bring back the whole business of monarchy. And
I didn't realize that.
That's, I think, why he introduced this term crown into the chemical literature.
And he, along with, I think, Cram and Jean-Marie Lane, all got a Nobel Prize
for
that.
Yes, in 1987, yeah.
Right, exactly.
Very deservedly so.
Yeah, it was
a game changer.
Everybody jumped onto them.
It's rather like
buckyballs nowadays.
Yeah, yeah. Well, everybody jumped on, but I saw it was very, very slow during the 70s. You know, you could virtually recite every paper that had been published. So it took well into the 80s before it started to take off. Of course, Jean-Marie Lane, more than any of the three laureates, gave it impetus by giving it this name, supramolecular chemistry.
So what's your particular goal in this supramolecular chemistry? What did you want to bring to it that wasn't there?
Well, I was able, and I think in your early career, you really are spending this 10,000 hours, which takes 10 years, becoming technically competent. So when I came to Sheffield, the research I did was to marry Pedersen's Crown Ethers to my carbohydrate experience. And I did this, and that introduced handedness, so-called chirality, into the molecules. And I concentrated on their complexation towards small organic guest molecules, as they were called, including amino acids. I was reasonably successful, but the point is both Jean-Marie Lane and Donald Cram had many years start on me. They had large research groups, so I was in many ways an also-ran during that time. But I have to say, both of them were incredibly supportive of the small amount of research that I achieved and published in the 70s.
So the little machines that people talk about now, I know, for example, in Texas, we've got Jim Tour down in Rice, who makes molecules, tiny little things in the shape of motor cars. Mm. That is, they've got big molecules on either side that act as wheels. Mm. And I think they just recently got the world record for speed of one of these little miniature molecules. And was it 90 nanometers per hour? This is the world record, according to Guinness. How does what you did fit into that and stimulate that sort of work?
Not too directly, to be very honest. I'm not a nanocar person, and no. I can explain, I think, down the road why that is the case. But we're still a long way away in my science from getting into machinery business. I had to take part, as it turned out, in helping the progress of the development of the so-called mechanical bond. And let me go back in time. There was a very good contribution from a German scientist called Gottfried Schill, and he published a book in 1971 called Catenanes, Rotaxanes, and Knots. And this became my Bible. And I did not have the resource, either human or equipment-wise, to be able to do very much in my early period at Sheffield. The door opened in being able to develop the first stages of the machines that were to be in 1978 when I went to the ICI corporate laboratory, extremely well equipped and very, very good collaborators. Plus, I picked up another collaborator at Imperial College London. I needed an absolutely outstanding X-ray crystallographer, somebody who could look at the solid state. And this man, David Williams, who now lives in New Zealand, is just an absolute whiz kid, or was. And that period from 78 to 81 while I was at ICI was the one that brought about the breakthrough to have the bits and pieces to make, first of all, shuttles, then switches, and then machines. And believe it or not, the bits and pieces were wipeout weed killers. So ICI were marketing two compounds called diquat and paraquat all around the world, including here in the United States. They're off the market now because they are rather toxic, but nonetheless, these became the building blocks for making the mechanical bond.
So tell us about the shuttle. Try to explain to the listener, what is this chemical shuttle that you're talking about?
So this is composed of a dumbbell-shaped entity that listeners could perhaps associate with weightlifters approaching a dumbbell-shaped object, which would be made, obviously, of a bar of steel with two big wheels at the end. At the molecular level, we call the long rod-like component an axle, and the parts at the end, stoppers. And the challenge is to be able to introduce at least one ring onto this dumbbell. And this is called a taxane because you have two components within a molecule that are not covalently linked. They're not linked by classical chemical bonds. So you have to introduce another type of bonding, the mechanical bond. And let me just say that I think this is the biggest discovery I've been associated with. It's not machines, it's the invention of the mechanical bond, because, you know, you can think in chemistry there are probably tens of thousands of compounds being made all around the world in a week. And maybe over a year, there'll be two or three, maybe a dozen or two new chemical reactions reported. It's only once in a blue moon that you have a new bond coming on the scene in chemistry that is a strong bond, and this was a mechanical bond.
So again, then, carry on and tell the listener what was the basis of this new type of strong mechanical bond.
Well, the thing that was built into it was that just as a weightlifter would have to put their hands onto two points on this dumbbell, and they would have to be such that it was a bell balance situation so that the person, he or she, could lift it up above their heads. In our context, where the hands would go would be sticky points along the axle. They would be points where the ring would prefer to sit most of the time, say 99% of the time, but still able to jump from one to the other at room temperature in solution a couple of thousand times a second. So that's why we were able to call it a molecular shuttle. We had this wonderful, very simple prototype device of a dumbbell with a ring jumping back and forth more than a nanometer in distance. This was a large amplitude motion, much bigger than you could get with chemical compounds of a traditional type.
And the stickiness, what was the root of the stickiness?
Well, it was basically electrostatic in nature. We describe it in our more fancy way as donor and acceptor stickiness. And so we would have donor type systems, entities in the rod component, that is, they're prepared to give up some of their electrons to the rings, which were containing units that were prepared to accept these electrons. And so something called charge transfer takes place, and a deal of cohesion, it's often called molecular recognition, occurs between these two components. And that's enough to make them sit on either the ring, one side or the other, but at no time on both of them, and very, very fleetingly in the space either between the two sticky sites or beyond them going towards the stopper. So you have this very precise piece of prototypical machinery that is just begging to be turned into a switch.
So talk a little bit more about the application. You talked...
We're still far away from applications. These are just...
You call it a switch.
Yes. I have to describe the switch first, and that means that we have to now take the dumbbell, the rod component, and change the degree of stickiness at, say, the left-hand side and the right-hand side. And so manufacture the dumbbell component so that there are two different types of recognition site. One that likes the ring much better than the other one. But you are able, with some little chemical trick, and it can be you add some acid, and the ring which is preferring one site then jumps to the other one. Add some base, and it will jump back again. So that was our first demonstration of a molecular switch in 1994. We could also control that with electricity under what's called an electrochemical cell.
One knows in the literature that some people have done changing conformations of molecules by light, so that you've got what we call the cis and then the trans,
yep,
and then crown ethers, in fact, rather like that. So you've got two crown ethers separated, and if they're cis, then they can sort of cooperate if they're trans. Yep. Did you ever come up with any ideas to make the switch photochemically active as opposed to acid-base?
Sure. We designed and made photochemically active switches. A lot of this work was done in collaboration with Vincenzo Bolzani in Bologna, a photochemist. So, you know, I've collaborated hugely throughout my career, and I always never hesitate to bring in the experts, the people who know more about a subject than I do. Our switches could be driven chemically, electrochemically, and photochemically.
That's pretty impressive. We've got about 3 or 4 minutes left, and would it be okay if we let's talk about how the prize has changed your life? Are you still as active doing science, or now do you find yourself like here today, running around the world talking and enthusing people and students and faculty also? I mean, what's different today than was 4 years ago before you had the prize, even though you were already Sir Fraser?
Well, it's very different, and the Nobel Prize in many ways is a game changer. It's difficult to work out why it has such a kudos, but there we are. It's not for me to argue with. So it presents you with many challenges, and one is to get it. Well, you receive a lot of invitations, and then from those, sift them out and decide what you can humanly take on board while you still keep a research group going. And so I'm trying to do both. I've, of course, been able to run my research group at a distance for many years. You know, the techniques that are available through the internet and so forth allow one to do this. But
What questions are you chasing now scientifically?
I'm not chasing a huge number of questions. I have two startup companies that I'm very interested in that have actually very little to do with the Nobel Prize. And my ambition there is to hope that one or both of them will be so successful that I can...
What do they make, produce?
Well, one of them is isolating gold by a very benign way, environmentally friendly way that gets rid of cyanide and mercury. The other one has multiple applications in home care, personal care, pharmaceuticals, petrochemicals, you name it. And at the moment, we're concentrating on personal care.
And these are molecules that you discovered and have patents on.
They're all well patented, yes.
Russell, as our listeners know, is a great man for startup companies. Mm-hmm. I don't know how many you've started up, but he's imaginative, I would say that, about science. Much more so than I. I like the result, but I don't have any idea on how to take it. And do you think, in fact, that's a good point to end on? I mean, should there be more entrepreneurship training for our students when they get PhDs and all the rest of it, or we just let the natural course of events take place?
Well, I think you can encourage entrepreneurship to come into being. I think it's like anything else in the academic scene, and role models, I think, are very important. If students are exposed to people who've been successful in being entrepreneurs, then there's a good chance that this will whet their appetite and they would want to follow in these people's footsteps.
The trouble, of course, is that most universities are populated by faculty who've got no clue about the real world. I mean...
Well, I don't know. I think I'm in a department where I'm surrounded by colleagues who have startup companies.
And yeah, so but that's
that was
Chicago.
A little... That is Northwestern, and that is chemistry at Northwestern. And so when I came there in 2007 without a startup company, I felt I was not as well introduced into the real world as many of my colleagues. And so not that it became a goal. The startup companies are both the result of serendipitous discoveries. And that's my other big argument today. If you give people space in doing research at a fundamental level, you will get more discoveries than if you try to direct it in a very top-down manner. And I think one of the great things about the research I've been able to do in the last 10 years is I've had a huge amount of freedom with my graduate students and postdocs to explore the unknown.
Well, you know, many famous scientists say that the science that we create should wind up helping people rather than just in a library somewhere.
Of course, yes. Not all of it's going to do that. I think there's the other component to the training of students, and I always want to advocate that the general public, through the journalists and the media, come to appreciate that someone like I'm a professor, and my first job in many ways is to teach. And I also look back on my whole 50 years with a huge amount of pleasure insofar as at the graduate level and the postdoc level, there's 500 people gone through my hands at over 50 years from about 50 different countries.
Well, that's a great place to stop, because that's what professors are. They are people who teach and they are people who educate. And the science and the research is one tool for making that occur. Fraser Stoddart, thank you so much for being here on Science Studio. You're remarkably fit and well, having just flown in from Australia, I must say that. And Russell, do you want to say anything to finish up with?
I just would like to say thanks to Lauren Terrazas, our producer. And also, I would like to say that the Scottish Enlightenment is very important.
And I agree with that, and I thank you both very much.
We'll be back next week with another Science Studio, so stay tuned.